Today we're going to reprise an interview that we conducted earlier this year with Joel Kotkin on his book, The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class. Joel argues how society is being rapidly reduced to a feudal state, a process now being exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. The big winners have been the expert class, he writes, of the clerisy, and most of all, the tech oligarchs who benefit as people rely more on algorithms than human relationships. This is definitely a must-read book. And as always, if you want to listen to all of the interviews that we air during the week on FS Insider, either through our website or through a podcast app of your choice on a mobile device, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. Countries around the globe are becoming more hierarchical, less dynamic, and more concentrated in wealth and power among a new progressive elite. Prospects for upward mobility for the middle and lower classes, however, continue to weaken, leading to greater polarization and a general erosion of the values necessary for the survival of a stable democratic society. Those at the top recognize this growing threat and are pinning their hopes on a radical mix of progressive policies and technological authoritarianism. There's a new book out that explores these issues and more. It's titled The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class, written by Joel Kotkin, who joins us today. Joel, thank you for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Let's start with what feudalism is and why it's making a comeback.
Well, feudalism, and obviously, you know, the feudalism we have today is not a bunch of guys going around in tights and wearing armor. What it is about a several characteristics that we're seeing return. One is hierarchy, tremendous concentration of power in very few hands. That was one of the major parts of feudalism, and a basic lack of upward mobility for most people. Slow population growth, that was certainly part of the Middle Ages. I think the growth of sort of an apocalyptic, almost to the point sometimes of insanity, ideology, which, you know, sees the world coming to an end, very similar to what you had in the Middle Ages. The development of a censorious, I call in the book the clerisy, a group of people, the media, academia, you know, the entertainment industry, which are completely dominated by one particular kind of ideology, and that anyone who dares differ, well, we don't burn them at the stake anymore, but we just cancel them. They go into non-existence. You know, somebody who made an inappropriate Facebook post 10 years ago can now be canceled for life. This is sort of a kind of thought control that we never saw. And one of the problems is technology allows for thought control to work more efficiently than it did in the Middle Ages. I mean, if somebody kept their thoughts to themselves, I guess you would be safe. And then what we're seeing is the end of the Middle Ages was driven by the rise of what I call the yeomanry, which is the small property-owning middle class, you know, the small investor, the small property owner, the small business person, the artisan. And these are the people who have been losing out for a while and in the pandemic are getting clobbered particularly. Under that is a serf class, the very bottom. And what's happening is the children of the yeomanry are becoming serfs. They can't buy a house. They can't really make much money. They end up not moving better than their parents, but actually living worse than their parents, which is not very good for the future of a democracy, that's for sure.
Again, the title of the book is The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class. There's hierarchy, lack of upward mobility, slow population growth, an apocalyptic ideology, as you said, and we'll get into that a little bit more. Clerisy, which forms a group of academia, media, higher education, progressive elites, and then this rise of yeomanry and serfs that see worsening of living conditions and lack of upward mobility, and there's a widening gap between those two. And of course, a lot of this goes back to what we saw during the Middle Ages. And now the question to you is, a lot of times when these issues are brought up, the focus is on the U.S., but right. You make it very clear that this is not just a U.S. phenomenon.
Oh, God, no. I mean, it's clearly a phenomenon that we see in lots of countries. Certainly in Europe, we see it increasingly in China. China has more of an inequality problem even than the United States does. And so we're seeing the same processes happening you know, really all over the world, but particularly in a lot of the more advanced countries, you know, the countries with higher incomes. And this is pretty much a universal trend. Now, some policies, for instance, in Europe, counteract some of the worst effects. But fundamentally, upward mobility is being reduced, you know, pretty much all over the world. And a very small group of people are now increasingly owning the land and owning the wealth. And now, with probably scariest of all, with tremendous control over the information. I mean, what we see now, I think it is terrifying that the tech oligarchs, with their ideology and worldview, are essentially buying up the media and certainly controlling the pipelines of the media. I find that absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, and that's where we start getting into the technological authoritarianism. And I want to get into that a little bit later with you, because that's a main feature of your book as well, which I think is very interesting. But sticking to the feudalism aspect first, as you pointed out, this is global in nature. It's particularly concentrated among the high-income advanced countries, although China is probably the worst in terms of wealth disparity and concentration of wealth. That said, what are some of the trends or factors that are leading to this global phenomenon?
Well, I think there are several things. One has been globalization itself, which has essentially seen the erosion of large parts of, let's say, the U.S. economy, moving much of it to China. The fact that when we had the pandemic, you couldn't even get masks because they were all being made in China. The other part of it is that you have increasing domination of the global culture by a small group of people. So a lot of the local culture goes. I mean, I'm thinking particularly like if you look at Hollywood. I lived in Los Angeles for 40 years and, you know, I still live in Southern California. And you basically have a global culture that adopts views that many people don't feel very comfortable about. I mean, you have actually a media culture, an entertainment culture, which basically writes off 50, 60% of the population from the beginning. Just you don't really matter. And what's interesting is the strategy in many cases of the media companies, and I know this from having been a columnist at the New York Times many years ago, I had a monthly column, is that you're going to go after the national elite. The New York Times is not the newspaper of New York. It's the paper of the national, if you want to put it this way, the national clerisy. It reflects those views. They don't really give a damn that anybody who is to the right of Barack Obama, you're not even trying to communicate with those people anymore, because, you know, particularly on cultural issues. So you've got this sort of cultural hegemony, again, very much like the Catholic Church. They decide what you can say, what you can't say, what you can think, and what you can't think.
I actually want to quote a portion of your book. I really like how you put this. You say that in terms of the clerisy, again, this is this group of academia, media, higher education, progressive elites that all think a certain way, exhibiting this cultural hegemony, as you referred to it. But you say, quote, "The modern clerisy often claims science as the basis of their doctrines and tout academic credentials as the key to status and authority. They seek to replace the bourgeois values of self-determination, family, community, and nation with progressive ideas about globalism, environmental sustainability, redefined gender roles, and the authority of experts. These values are inculcated through the clerisy's dominance over the institutions of higher learning and media, aided by the oligarchy's control of information technology and the channels of culture." I don't think it can be said better than that.
Well, thank you.
So tell us about some of these values, which in portion of your book you say this is essentially the new religion.
When you have, let's say, 90% of the faculty left of center, and particularly in the humanities, but now moving into the sciences as well, you are able to inculcate in these students. I mean, what I notice in many cases is many students have never been exposed. I'm not talking about conservative ideas. I'm talking about classically liberal ideas. I mean, I think the idea, you know, let's say of Franklin Roosevelt saying that, you know, wanting a nation of homeowners, you're not going to read about that and learn about that in school. I mean, if people think that the history of the United States is the New York Times 1619 project, how do you communicate with them? How do you explain to them that, you know, there was this thing called the Civil War and, you know, the North won and they had more people and they were much wealthier than the South? This notion that American history is just one collection of horrors after another, well, then I want to know why millions of people came here. I mean, if it was such a terrible place to be, why did they come? Even today, they'll say, well, it's an irredeemingly racist country. Then tell me why people from Africa are lining up to come to this country. Why is it that so many of our tech companies are run by people who come from Iran or from China or from India? Why are we acting as if this is such a horribly racist country? I mean, yes, America has some very, very horrible experiences with slavery, which we did the first war ever fought really to eliminate slavery. And we also have the experience with the Native Americans. I mean, these are certainly problems that all the countries like Australia and Canada also had some of the same issues. But the bottom line is that, yes, for all this negative stuff, but all the good things that happened, all the people who, if I think of my own family, my grandfather was from Latvia. That was the first part of Russia to become Judenrein, to eliminate all the Jews, okay? This is a country that literally saved my family's life. I mean, and there are many, many people who, whether it was their lives or their opportunities, they came to this country and their lives were made much better. And they come in all different ethnicities, religions, and colors. And we've left that story go. And one of the key issues that I raise in neo-feudalism is that what you've done is doing what the Catholic Church did to the classical culture. It took the classical culture, which had some bad aspects to it for sure, and sort of said, it's evil. And we had to wait really until the Arabs rediscovered the Greek and Roman culture and people got re-exposed to it, that we began to see that there was something very great in that heritage. And the elimination of heritage, and even scarier to me, I've been to China and interviewed former Red Guards. The Red Guards tried to destroy the entire culture of China, one of the great civilizations of all time. And we're seeing the same things happen now. So, you know, when people say, oh, well, we tore down Ulysses Grant, we thought he was like a Confederate general. How did you go through school and not know who U.S. Grant was? Besides the fact that he happened to have also been an abolitionist, but, you know, this is a guy who was the primary architect of the winning of the Civil War.
Yeah, and persecuted the KKK, too. He cracked down on them as well.
Right. And even to go after great men like Frederick Douglass, you know, the degree of insanity. And this is what happened in various times during medieval times, where you just got this insane culture and becomes increasingly, like during the Counter-Reformation, increasingly intolerant, increasingly directive, telling people how to think, what they can say, and more importantly, what you can't say. For instance, Mike Schellenberger wrote a very excellent book called Apocalypse Never. Mike is a long-term environmentalist and very active in the environmental movement for, you know, 20, 30 years. And Mike, because he made the point that they had over-exaggerated and that many of the solutions were hurting working people, he got taken off of Forbes and then he got taken off of Facebook because somebody objected. Somebody who says that the world is coming to an end, and most, you know, serious scientists don't think the world's coming to an end in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. They can say it, and it will never be taken down. I mean, this is just terrifying from the point of view of free speech.
Yeah, and I think that's where you start to get into technological authoritarianism, particularly how we're seeing it exhibited in China. I think we're all very aware of the fact that they have, you know, very strong control over what type of information can be shared, what yes. the news can say. And yet, we're seeing that also spread from China to other nations that are using China as their role model, but we're also seeing that here in the U.S. and in the Western world as well, maybe in a softer form, maybe a Brave New World type form right. of it.
Well, I think in China, the threat is fundamentally from the Communist Party and the government. In this country, the threat is mostly from private oligopolies. But the reality is, what are you going to do when we have a federal government that's controlled by people who share the same ideology and actually think it's great? This could be very scary. We could be entering an era of thought control that we haven't seen for maybe almost any time in American history. And that I find just terrifying.
You talk about how these tech companies are also enabling this feudalistic type environment. There's also this belief that, you know, hey, maybe you don't need to possess things. You can have a very small, reduced lifestyle in order to reduce your environmental footprint, of course. And I really like where you write, the focus on apartment living for employees makes some sense for tech companies like Facebook, Lyft, Salesforce, Square, Twitter, Yelp, and Google that rely on a youthful, childless workforce. This kind of urban experience does not spur individuals toward independent adulthood and a family formation, but recreates life as close to the college experience as possible, or a kind of prolonged adolescence. And you talk about how we see a massive reduction in formation of families among particularly the millennial generation, and perhaps even going further down than that, and how that does not bode well for the future of a democratic society.
Family formation has historically been the basis of society, and it is one of the things that we have, which the government can't control, okay? That's a very important factor. And the problem that you have, there's very little affirmation for the family. It's coming from several directions. A, the Greens don't want people to have kids, okay? And they don't want them to live in houses. So obviously, family is not something that they think is very important. Then you have the more extreme elements of the sort of gender studies group who consider the family as a reactionary, regressive thing. And then you look at the media. Much of the media now, you watch a movie and you think, well, doesn't anyone ever have kids? You know, so you have a culture that is really, in many ways, fundamentally hostile to the nuclear family. Having spent a year reading things about the Middle Ages to put this together, the family did not have a high status in medieval society. I mean, it was not, you know, remember, because Arius writes about this in his History of Childhood. Middle Ages, you know, people didn't, it wasn't family-centric. Family-centric, the culture in the West, really, you start to see it in the Netherlands in about the 17th century is the beginning of it. And it was very tied to the idea of the bourgeois, of the small property owner. It is very much involved in the fact that something that stands between you and the state. And of course, as you well know, in communist societies, particularly in the Soviet Union, they didn't like the idea of the family because the family was something that stood between the individual and the state. And we're seeing that kind of ideology today.
You write here that perhaps no institution is more threatened by the neo-feudal order than the traditional family structure. And then go on to say that today, many large cities such as Beijing, Tokyo, New York, Los Angeles, Boston, San Francisco are becoming childless demographic graveyards.
Right. And that's definitely the case. I mean, and it's going to be accelerated as the L.A. schools, the New York schools don't open. People are going to start looking for other alternatives. Either they're going to move to the suburbs where maybe the schools will open, or they're going to look for independent online sources. So this process is continuing, and I think that, and you have to also look into the fact that I think families are going to, you know, particularly be threatened by the rise in crime. And that was also one of the reasons why people moved. You know, people always talk about white flight as being a racist reaction. And I think there was an element of that for sure. But a lot of black families left also. And I think you're going to see families certainly continuing to leave the cities in a major way. Because when you have more crime and disorder, you know, if you have kids, you're particularly concerned. If you were a parent in Chicago, would you want your kids to go to a park? So, I mean, what's a great irony is that by embracing these policies, the people who get hurt the most are the very people, minorities, immigrants, young people, who progressives say that they want to help.
Yeah, and you make a point of that, particularly when it comes to environmental policies, by trying to push civilization into adopting more green technologies, which end up costing more and making costs of living higher and living standards less, because they're not the most economically efficient.
The question is, can we resist these trends? And the first thing that we can do is recognize that they exist. Once you recognize the nature of the problem, at least you can start to think about solutions.
So what are some of the solutions? What are some of the ways that this future, neo-feudalist future, can be challenged or slowed? Is there anything you think that can be done about this, or is this inevitable?
Well, no, I think there are several things. One, I think we can demand, for instance, in terms of the tech companies, either they accept antitrust, we break them up, or they have to accept to be regulated like utilities, because that's what they are. You know, they now, when you've got 80-90% of market share, you no longer can say, hey, we're a free market company. Because, you know, what happens today is anybody comes up with a technology in social media, they get bought by Facebook. So the same, you know, the sort of entrepreneurial and free market system doesn't work when somebody controls 90% of a market and has almost unlimited financial resources. It just doesn't work that way. Second of all, we really are going to have to develop other forms of media that are independent of the current media. There needs to be alternatives. I mean, I don't consider myself a conservative, but I think my friend Glenn Reynolds has it right in that if the so-called, you know, conservative billionaires put their money into building alternative media, alternative studios, it would make much more sense than backing a bunch of corrupt politicians, which is what they do these days. So you have to counter this. And then you have to have policies that make it possible for people to buy property, to buy houses. And unfortunately, the planning regime, and I write about this in the book, the planning regime wants people to live in apartments in dense urban areas where they'll never be able to buy anything. And so we have to be thinking about how do we find ways of recreating the success we had, let's say, with the GI Bill, where, you know, people like in my own family, people came who had been living in the slums of New York, which is where most of my family came from. And what did they do? They came back from the war. They got a GI loan. Eventually, they went to college and they bought a house. We have to figure out how do we get back to that position, not for everybody, but for it to be a reasonable aspiration. I mean, right now, in a place like California, coastal California, if you don't have a family income of $150,000, you really can't buy a house. And then I also think in the education system, we have to find some middle ground between the kind of PC education that's now being shoved on people. There has to be some sense of balance. And finally, Western societies in particular, given the onslaught that's coming from China, which is now the authoritarian model, we have to have a sense of belief in yourself. If you don't believe in your own culture and you're fighting against somebody who has a intact view of their culture, you're not going to win. You know, I mean, America won the Cold War and America also helped beat Nazi Germany because we still believed in ourselves, even though we were coming out of a depression, you know, out of a very tough period in American history. If we don't believe in our own culture and in the intrinsic strength of the Constitution, the importance of at least some degree of religious belief, if we don't believe in the country and what it offered and what holds a society together, there's no way that we can stop the world from being shaped into a sort of feudalistic era where basically the Chinese model is pretty dominant.
And so in that case, if we do not see these trends reversed, it sounds like we would expect in a lot of these high-income countries where we see these forces at work towards a neo-feudal future, greater levels of societal unrest and heavy-handed use of technological authoritarianism, as you said, which is what we see in China and is spreading into other parts of the globe as well. So it sounds like...
Yeah, I mean, this is what Aldous Huxley made the point, that a technologically enabled dictatorship would be very hard to overthrow. When you can control... Just think about this in 5 years, where... You know, you may have a situation where literally my daughter's generation won't even have access to information that's contrary to the party line. I mean, that's where we're headed. And of course, when you think about it, Mark Zuckerberg and Sergey Brin and Bill Gates, they didn't invent the Internet. The Internet was developed by the Defense Department, paid for by the taxpayers in the United States. And yet we now see it being taken over instead of being a public square where everybody participates, increasingly into a privatized sphere where a small group of people make all the money and make the decisions about what we learn and what we don't learn.
Well, Joel, I want to thank you for coming on our show, sharing some of the key insights from your book. I know that we just scratched the surface. I would definitely highly encourage all of our listeners to go out and purchase a copy of your book. Again, the title is The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class.
Thank you very much.
If you have any questions or feedback on what we discussed today with Joel about his book, feel free to email me directly. My email address is CRIS, that's Chris with no H, at financialsense.com. And again, if you'd like to subscribe to our FS Insider podcast that airs 3 days every week, where we interview industry insiders, financial and economic experts, book authors, and market strategists from around the world, all you have to do is go to our website, financialsense.com, and click the subscribe button. Lastly, keep in mind, when you do subscribe, you can listen either through our website at financialsense.com or through a podcast app of your choice, which you can listen to on your mobile device. For FS Insider, I'm Chris Sheridan. Thanks for listening.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.